Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Here's the question that we want to try to discuss this morning in the first hour of the show. What is the best way to persuade adolescents to put off having sex? Now, for some time now, there have been two rival camps in this conversation. On the one side, we have people who argue that there really can be only one message, and that message should be just say no to sex before marriage. However, there are also some people who say that's a fine message to give, but they also believe that young people should have broad education in sex and human sexuality, and that includes giving them information about birth control. The idea there is that we may well tell our children we don't want them having sex, but we know that they're not always going to do what it is that we ask them to do or want them to do, and that if they're going to be sexually active, we at the very least want them to use contraception. So here this morning in this part of the show, we'll try to talk a little bit about what we know about these approaches and generally to that question, what's the best way to talk with adolescents about sex and get them to delay their sexual activity, and also talk a little bit about what we know about adolescent sexual behavior. And our guest for the show, for this hour, is Dr. John Santelli. He is a pediatrician and adolescent medicine specialist. Currently, he is professor of clinical population and family health in the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University, where he also chairs the Department of Population and Family Health. He recently joined the School of Public Health at Columbia. Before that, he was the chief of the Applied Sciences branch in the Division of Reproductive Health at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He has done research on sexually transmitted disease risk behaviors, on programs to prevent STDs and unintended pregnancy among adolescents and women. Also, he's done research on school-based health centers, clinical reproductive services, and research ethics. He's been a national leader in ensuring that adolescents are appropriately included in health research. And he's joining us this morning by telephone, and we're pleased to have him as guest. Questions are welcome. We certainly would invite people into the program, but we ask people, please be brief in your comments so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different callers as possible. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So either one, whether you're here locally or you're listening somewhere around Illinois or Indiana or someplace else out in the country, one of the other numbers will work for you. Again, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. And Dr. Santelli, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. And yourself?
We're great. Enjoying our vacation up here in Western New York, up by the lake with the kids and my wife, and it's a beautiful day.
Well, that's great. I'm glad to hear it. We have to be going back to work probably sooner than you would like.
Everybody's looking at that Labor Day deadline, I guess, to get back to teaching.
Well, let me ask you just to start us out here. Let's talk numbers a little bit and talk about what we know currently about adolescent sexual behavior. And I suppose here the key question really is at what age do boys and girls have their first sexual intercourse? What do we know about where those numbers are today? And then let's look back, 10, 20 years and talk about what the trend over time has been.
Sure. Happy to talk about those issues. The first thing I'd say, there's been a big success story in the last 15 years in this country. Teen pregnancy rates have dropped very considerably, by a full third. Among the younger kids, it's almost half, and so that's part of the good news. If you look at teen sexual behaviors, about half of kids in high school have initiated sex or had sexual intercourse for the first time. It's about half. If you look at the median age of first sex in America, it's about age 17 and a half. And that's the latter statistic is pretty true of most developed countries. If you look at the most of the countries in Western Europe, you look at Canada, other countries. Again, that median age, the age at which half of teenagers have initiated, is about 17, 17 and a half. So now if you turn to the trend side of the picture, you know, clearly there was a sexual revolution. Somewhere in the 60s, that percentage went up pretty dramatically. We have, we know it started in the 60s. We actually have better data from the 70s, but it almost doubled from about a quarter to almost half of 15 to 19-year-olds reporting that they'd ever had sex. It continued to decrease in the 80s, and since about 1990, it looks like it turned around, at least for about 10 years, and most recently seems to have flattened out a little bit.
That's the. I want to go on and talk some more about why we think this happened. But let me ask you just to follow up on one detail there, because sure. I think that a lot of people were very pleased. They thought that it was a good news here, that the headline is that over a period of time we saw a fairly steady decrease in the numbers of adolescents having sex and the age at which they first had their first sexual experience. And then we get to this point, and I'm thinking that maybe it's around 2001, where the rate of decline suddenly levels off. And a lot of people have looked at that and said and seem to be concerned that the rate of decline had stopped. And that they're wondering, well, what does that mean? And does that mean that we might then see it go up again, where then we would have more kids having sex and having sex younger? I mean, what do you make of the fact that we have this fairly steady period of decline and then we had this leveling off?
Yeah, that's a very good question, David. You've obviously been reading up on the subject. It is pretty unprecedented that it actually turned around. I mean, in most countries around the globe, it clearly the percentage of teenagers having sex increased in through the 60s and 70s and 80s, and then sort of leveled out. You know, and no other country has seen this turnaround. I've talked to other researchers about this. No one else has seen it, but we did see a small but sizable decrease in the percentage of high school students who were ever had sex, and that went down from about 1991 when they started what's called the Youth Risk Behavior Survey, which is a national survey of high school kids. It went down from 1991 to 2001. It went down from about overall about 54% to about 46%. And the survey's done every 2 years, which makes it a very good data set to measure, to look at trends. Because you got lots of measurements, it's a big sample, so you don't have to worry about issues like statistical stability and those sorts of things. Since about 2001, it's been flat. It's been about 46%, and it really hasn't changed very much. Obviously, there is a little statistical variation around any trend line, so it's difficult for, you know, epidemiologists or demographers, people that study this, to know exactly what's going on. But it clearly looks like it's, when we saw it flattening out between 01 and 03, everybody said, well, let's see what it shows. But now that we have 2 years where it's pretty flat, it looks more like a real trend, if you will. So that's the big change. I mean, the other, you know, of course, if you're thinking about pregnancy rates, you also have to think about the other solution, if you will, which is to get teenagers to be better users of contraception. And throughout the 90s and into the current decade, we've seen good increases in contraceptive use. And so, it looks like the contraceptive use stuff is, the contraceptive trends have continued through 2005, which is the most recent year we got the data. Hmm. Does that make sense to you?
I think, well, at least it's clear. Whether it makes sense, that's another question. Let me just very quickly here, I'd like to introduce again our guest, and also for people who are listening, pass on just a little bit of weather information. The Storm Prediction Center has issued a severe thunderstorm watch for parts of central Illinois that will be in effect until 3 o'clock this afternoon. So there's the chance of hail and high thunderstorm winds and lightning in these areas. And in the immediate AM 580 area, here are the counties that are included: Shelby, Christian, Sangamon, Clark, Cumberland, and Moultrie. So you just want to keep in mind that the severe thunderstorm watch means conditions are favorable for severe storms in and close to the watch area. So you just keep aware of the weather and stay tuned to AM 580. Of course, if we have more weather information, we'll bring it to you. Again, that's a severe thunderstorm watch that will be in effect for parts of central Illinois until 3 o'clock this afternoon. And, of course, we'll try to keep you updated on what happens here on the weather throughout the day here on AM 580. Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with John Santelli. He chairs the Department of Population and Family Health at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. He is a pediatrician and adolescent medicine specialist who is particularly interested in things like risk behaviors that lead to increased risk for sexually transmitted disease and programs to prevent that and unintended pregnancy, particularly among adolescents and women. And we're looking at what we can say now about sexual behavior in adolescents, and we want to tie this also to how it is we talk with them about sex and sexual behavior. So questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. In a second here, I want to get to this whole question of comprehensive sex ed versus abstinence. But first, if we ask this question, if we look at these trends and we say, at least for a long time, the trends were positive in that it seemed that the rates of teen pregnancy were declining. The rates of sexual activity among teenagers were also declining. So we see that kids seem to be waiting longer to have sex. And if they were having sex, they were using contraception so that the pregnancy rates were going down. How does one account for that? How do you explain those changes in behavior?
Well, again, Dave, that's a very good question. I mean, you know, from a scientific point of view, there's really two explanations, and those are the two you just gave. There could be fewer kids having sex, more kids using contraception or better contraception. So you can essentially, both conceptually and mathematically, divide the decline in the teen pregnancy rate into those two, if you will, components. And we've actually done, when I was at CDC, we did the first paper on this, and since I moved to New York, we did the second paper on this, looking at different data sets. They give slightly different answers because they're slightly different age groups and time periods. We initially looked at the period between 91 and 2001 using high school student data and found that it was about half and half. Half of the decline was due to increased abstinence, if you will, and half to improved contraceptive use. The second study looked at the period between 95 and 2002 and used a different data set, the National Survey of Family Growth, which is a household survey. It includes women 15 to 44, and we looked at the teenagers. The advantage of the NSFG is it includes kids who are out of school who are, you know, arguably at higher risk of teen pregnancy than those who go to school. That study suggested among the younger kids, the 15 to 17-year-olds, about a quarter of the decline was due to abstinence, increased abstinence, and about three-quarters was due to increased contraception. Mm-hmm. So those are the sort of two current national estimates on trying to explain why those pregnancy rates have been going down.
Well, let's talk for a moment here about abstinence-only education.
Sure.
As I said at the beginning, there are some people who say, well, if we If we don't want our kids getting pregnant, we don't want them getting sexually transmitted disease, we don't want them sexually active when they're younger, what we should say to them is just don't have sex, and don't have sex until you're married. And that there are a lot of people who believe in this approach. It's been rather politicized. And there also has, in recent years, been significant amounts of money, government money, put into funding programs, education programs like this. So for some people, I think it might have been, depending on how you feel about this, on the one hand, it might have been vindication. On the other hand, it might have been disappointment when earlier this spring, we had some studies come out that said there is no evidence to believe that abstinence-only education is really effective. What do we know about the effect on kids and how they think about sex and what they do of abstinence-only sex education?
And David, I start out by saying I really think abstinence is a smart and a healthy choice for young people, particularly younger teens. But it's a smart and can be a healthy choice for somebody at any age who's not ready to engage in sexual intercourse. And, you know, I think the issue of being ready is very important for young people and adults, too. I think abstinence only is a terrible idea. I think there's a number of reasons to say that. I mean, the concept of abstinence only is that you teach that as the only option to young people. In fact, you don't provide them any information about contraception or condoms or other kinds of risk reduction that you might think about. As a pediatrician, as a father, I mean, I feel like you're giving kids only part of the story. And you're not really preparing them for life because, you know, the data we just talked about suggests, you know, by age 17, half of young people have begun to have sex. So, if you're giving abstinence-only education to a classroom full of 11th graders, you're really sort of missing the boat, because many of them are going to be sexually active, and frankly, we don't know how to get kids to stop. In fact, we have some good scientific evidence about how to get them to delay, and let me talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily because of the AIDS epidemic, there's been a lot of interest in, you know, reducing adolescent sexual risk behaviors, including getting kids to delay, getting kids to use condoms, getting kids to reduce the number of sexual partners and avoid casual relationships. And, because of that, we actually have a pretty good body of knowledge, both on sex education, HIV prevention education, and most recently, we now have some pretty good evidence on so-called abstinence education. The paradox here is there are now about eight, well-done studies of abstinence-only education, including the one you mentioned that was released this spring from the federal government. It was done by a group called Mathematica that showed absolutely no impact of four of the more commonly used abstinence education programs. The great paradox here, though, is so I think that's pretty clear. But the great paradox here is that there are probably 30 or 40 or 50, depending on how you count them, studies of comprehensive sex ed, and about half of those show that they can, between a third and a half, show that they can get kids to delay initiation of sex. So if the goal is to help kids delay, it's pretty clear that actually, the comprehensive sex ed does a better job. And that's the great paradox, is the political debate has gotten polarized around abstinence only, and the federal funding now is primarily for abstinence only, but the programs that seem to work best are the so-called comprehensive, or some people call them abstinence plus,
mm-hmm.
Kinds of programs.
Well, let me ask you this then, because, you know, having read a number of articles about this, it seems that in articles that deal with this subject, particularly, you know, those that look at abstinence-only education, there certainly seems to be anecdotal evidence that they work, and maybe that's the key term there. So it makes it sort of difficult to believe that. Well, I'm sure that for some people, they would find it difficult to accept a study that says this doesn't work at all. No way, none, period. Particularly if they feel that people they know, their children, their friends' children, that's the message that they're giving, and that their children are not sexually active. So they're saying, well, what do you mean? How can you tell me that this doesn't work? Because I know from my personal experience that it does.
Well, that's a great question. Again, that's the dilemma scientists often face. I mean, there are sort of what you call rules for evidence in terms of research design and, you know, what's really true. And scientists go, you know, sort of bend over backwards to make sure they got their science right. Sure. I mean, I'm convinced there's somebody out there that's probably benefited from an abstinence-only program. But if you look at the programs overall, they don't help kids delay. You know, at least in the whole group of kids. So some kids may delay, and some may start a little earlier because of the program. And so the net effect is overall they don't work. So I think that's the dilemma. I think a lot of people believe in these programs. A lot of people believe in the goal of abstinence, and I think it's a fundamental value that grows out of religious traditions and religious beliefs, and so I wouldn't question that. But what I would suggest as a scientist that, you know, however they're designed, they haven't been working at all so far.
We're just about at our midpoint here, and I have a caller we'll get right to in just a second, and maybe I should again introduce our guest, Dr. John Santelli. He is a pediatrician and adolescent medicine specialist. He's department chair of population and family health and is also professor of clinical population and family health at the Mailman School of Public Health, and that's at Columbia University. And he's done a lot of research on this subject and others having to do with sexually transmitted disease risk behaviors and programs to prevent STDs and unintended pregnancy, school-based health centers, all of that. Before becoming active there as a faculty member at Columbia, he was chief of the Applied Sciences Branch in the Division of Reproductive Health at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here, someone in Longview, and that is line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. As is often the case with the discussion of this topic, the immediate focus becomes that of teenage pregnancy. And my concerns are, as I've observed over the decades, that intercourse is becoming less and less a focus of early teenage sexual experience than other certainly equally risky, not so much for pregnancy, but for STD behaviors. And I'm talking here about oral sex, anal intercourse, these sorts of things that even I and others who are rather open-minded still find a little bit disconcerting and would be, I'm sure, much more comfortable discussing with our children than the act of intercourse. And I imagine those advocates of abstinence-only education would possibly suffer explosion of their heads to even think about the topics of the behaviors I've talked about. How do we not only address the issue of discussing sexual intercourse with our children and pregnancy prevention, and then get beyond that to what I think are increasingly popular activities that younger people are participating in, if as I said, even people who are more comfortable than most with the idea of sexuality are uncomfortable with these topics that have not been a part of our early sexual experiences. And I'm going to hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Well, Dr. Santelli, what can you say about that?
A lot of great issues there. I think the first is that I don't know, again, as a pediatrician, as a father, I'm a firm believer that we need to teach kids all these issues and need to explore them in a respectful, age-appropriate way, you know, in the public schools. And there has to be, as part of that, a dialogue with parents. I think parents set values for kids, and the school system provides information. You know, as the caller suggested, he didn't get all that information. I know, I dare say I didn't get it in high school either when I was growing up in the 60s. I think kids need information about the risks of things like oral and anal sex. So, that's why, I support comprehensive sex ed. But the other piece of it, the information is, again, going back to anecdote, there's been a big concern about oral and anal sex. And clearly anal sex is very risky for HIV and STDs. Oral sex has some risk, but it's actually STDs are less commonly transmitted that way. And actually the big risk factor for, if you look at all the STD studies, and in fact most of the HIV studies as well, the biggest risk factor is multiple sexual partners. Now, sometimes that's the kind of serial monogamy that one sees among teenagers. You know, one dates and breaks up and then dates again. But sometimes it's actually multiple concurrent partners, having two or three partners at the same during the same period of time. And that's the biggest risk factor. And again, I think sex education really needs to talk to young people about relationships and, not jumping in bed with people before one is ready, how one, you know, how to think about, I think even the school system should talk about values. Should talk about, you know, encourage kids, for instance, the school should encourage kids to talk to their parents and their ministers and, you know, trusted adults about what their values are and what's safe and smart to do.
Hmm. Well, just to draw a line under this, then, do you think that it is the case that in our sex education, the way that we talk with our children either at home or at school perhaps has put too much I'm not sure too much is the right word, has emphasized prevention of pregnancy to the exclusion of other things, and so that we do have kids who are engaging in sexual behaviors that have some risks attached. Pregnancy might not be one of them, but they have other risks attached, and then they're saying, well, it's okay, I can do this without, it's not going to be a problem because I'm not going to get pregnant or nobody's going to get pregnant. And they are exposing themselves to other kinds of risks, and the big one, I suppose, would be sexually transmitted disease, and that they're just going out there and doing it and thinking, well, if I can't get pregnant, that this is not a problem.
Well, again, that's absolutely right. One can get STDs. One can get HIV from sexual behavior, even though you don't get pregnant. My sense, though, is that the good sex education in this country is talking about STDs mm-hmm. and HIV. I don't think kids are not hearing about those. Even the abstinence-only programs all start out with the risk of STDs and HIV. But it needs to be in a context. I mean, actually, just as the pregnancy rates are going down, many of the STD rates are going down. Now, there's multiple STDs, so it gets complicated here. But, you know, the ones that we've had the best data on over time all seem to be going down. So that's good news as well. So, and I think there's another myth out there, another anecdote, is that many more kids are having oral sex. There's actually not any data to support that. The data that looks at it over time, the little data we have, doesn't support that. And some research we're doing currently suggests that generally kids initiate oral sex about the same time they initiate vaginal sex. So it's not so much the risk of oral sex. It's, again, goes back to how many sexual partners you're having. Mm-hmm. But kids are not. I mean, this nonsense about rainbow parties is really an urban myth.
Just let me ask you another question about comprehensive sex ed. Now, the idea of that is that children should get a broad-based kind of sexual education, talk about human sexuality in the widest possible way, including information about contraception. And that can certainly be, and perhaps should be, in conjunction with an abstinence message. But there are some parents who say, well, yes, I want my children to have the message that I don't want them engaging in sex. At the same time, I know that they don't always do what I want, and when they're out of my sight, I'm not sure what they're going to be doing. So I also, some parents would say, I would also want to say to them, if you are going to be engaging in sex, use contraception, because there's possibility of unintended pregnancy and there's possibility of sexually transmitted disease. The people on the abstinence-only side look at that and say, you know, you're if you start out saying, I don't want you having sex, and then you say, but if you do have sex, I want you to use contraception, they're going to say, you're undercutting your abstinence message. You can't do that. And so that's why they say, they make the argument for abstinence only, because they say this is a clear, straightforward message. And if you do the other stuff, then it's a mixed message. And I guess I wonder how it is you react to that kind of criticism of comprehensive sex education, and how it is that what we think we know about how kids size up those two messages, weigh those two messages, if they're getting both an abstinence message and the other message that says, but if you are going to be sexually active, we want you to have protection.
Yeah, I think that's been the big fear on the part of folks who support only abstinence, that it's going to undermine, that message. I don't think there's a lot of evidence for that, scientific evidence. One can look to a couple places. One can look to, polling data. If you ask kids and adults whether whether most people think that's a mixed message, most people suggest they don't think it's a mixed message. You can look at comprehensive programs that deliver both messages. And again, as we talked about, the paradox there is those programs seem to be the most effective at both goals, getting kids to delay initiation and to use contraception better. So all I can say is there's lots of good models out there for sex education that I think refute the myth of a mixed message.
Hmm. Okay, let's talk with someone in Marshall, and this would be line number 4 right here. Hello.
Yeah. Hi. I just want to throw this into the mix. My granddaughter, who is attending a major university in Illinois, just told me last week that when she came to university, she thought drinking would be the first major vice and sex would be the second, but she has found out that sex is the first, and many of her friends and people she knows, that's just, they try to find as many partners as they can and just go out, and that's what you do for the evening. So, and also I've heard that the University of Illinois is no longer going to offer free birth control or counseling, and I'll just throw that into the mix. Thank you.
All right. Well, this may, I don't know if now we're talking about a different kind of situation. If you're talking about, I guess I'm thinking primarily in our conversation here, we've been focused on, young people of high school age and perhaps younger. And I don't know if we're talking about a different kind of situation when we have people who are of college age, so we're getting, I don't know what that would be, 18, 19, 20 years old.
Well, I think, but, 18 is a legal separation between, middle adolescence and later adolescence. But clearly, lots of these risk behaviors continue beyond age 18. Interesting article in USA Today yesterday about, risk in drinking and other behaviors among, 20-somethings. I'll give you an anecdote. It's always describe what the problems with anecdotes are. Let me give you one of my own. I gave a talk at a pretty good university on the East Coast, about 6 months ago. And afterwards, this young woman was waiting around to ask me the last question. And she revealed to me that she was a freshman and she was 18 and very well-educated, smart gal who'd gotten into this fairly exclusive university. And she basically said she had no idea how people got pregnant, how they got STDs. She said all she'd ever been taught about was abstinence. And she had a boyfriend, and she wasn't telling me she was having sex yet, but she just had no idea what she should be doing about these things. And I worry that that's the generation of kids that we're producing today, that they just haven't had the education to prepare them for life, you know, whether it's college life or, you know, adult, you know, going into the workforce. I'm worried about those kids. You know, I mean, the other piece of the question related to alcohol use, and clearly alcohol use and binge drinking, which we see a deplorable amount on college campuses, is also related to multiple partners and the risk of multiple partners. What the woman described, what the caller described, was people drinking too much, perhaps, and then, you know, not being very smart about who they had sex with. And I think that's a very dangerous, you know, alcohol is dangerous because of injuries and, you know, overdose, but it's also a risk factor for risky sexual behavior.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think, I think that some people would say that when people first started to become aware of HIV, and when there was a lot of attention on that, mm-hmm. that certainly influenced people's sexual behavior, and perhaps they understood that high risk sexual behavior was problematic. That is, it was increasing their risk, and maybe they changed their behavior. And then some people said the longer we've been living with HIV, the more that just seems to become sort of a routine part of the background, is that people lose the edge of it seems to have worn off. And so people perhaps aren't as worried about it as they were when that was a new idea and we were talking about it a lot. I mean, do you think that that people, particularly young people, are now just more their attitude toward the possibility of sexually transmitted disease is more blasé, that they're just not that worried about it?
Well, I think there's truth in all three of those things you said. I think actually concern about HIV was a big part of the decline in teen pregnancy rates, because the two biggest changes in behavior was, again, this small but sizable change in abstinence. But the primary change in contraceptive use has actually been a big increase in condom use. And that, boy, condom use among teenagers skyrocketed in the 80s and continued in the 90s, and it's continued up to the present day. So I think a lot of teenagers are trying to be responsible, or trying to take care of business, is what they say, you know, and prevent STDs and HIV. So I think we've made some progress on that, and I think, you know, we have, you know, all the work that many, many people did to raise AIDS awareness in the 80s, including people like Surgeon General Koop with his early report in 87, but just a lot of people contributed to making us all a lot smarter. Now, it's also true, this last piece you just talked about, that we've now got condom rates pretty high levels among teenagers, but it's, on some level, it can be difficult to maintain. And what we see, particularly among young gay kids, is sort of resurgence of risk behavior, non-use of condoms, too many partners, and that is a recipe for disaster. And a number of places, San Francisco, New York, elsewhere, we've seen increasing HIV infections because of that. And that's, and along with things like syphilis and other STDs. So, you know, education is something you have to repeat every year. I mean, there's a new group of kids coming through, and I guess school teachers know this. You have to keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it. So we can't let our guard down, because these infections are out there.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. John Santelli. He is professor of clinical population and family health at Columbia University. He's a pediatrician and adolescent medicine specialist. Before coming to New York, he was chief of the applied sciences branch in the Division of Reproductive Health at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and has done research on sexually transmitted disease risk behaviors and on programs to prevent STDs and unintended pregnancy. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Given that, as you say, there have been a number of studies now, one that got a fair amount of attention in the press in the spring, we talked a little bit about, and also some previous to that, that show that the abstinence-only sex education programs are not effective. Has that already begun to affect, or is that going to affect the funding for those programs? Because there were a number of years in which there was significant federal money going into those programs because people believed in them so strongly. Is there now, will those kind of programs, do you think, be de-emphasized?
Well, you know, never underestimate the wisdom of politicians. But I got to say, I read the papers every day, and I've been astounded to see the what's going on in Washington about these issues. It seems like one week the programs are going to be defunded, and then the next week they're going to be refunded. And there's clearly strong support among social conservatives for these kind of programs. For, as you said, there's clearly lots and lots of scientific criticism of the programs. There's other kinds of criticisms. You know, people have taken the programs to task on sort of an ethical point of view, that you shouldn't withhold life-saving information from young people. So politics is always funny business, and I think what's gonna emerge out of this, and what I hope emerges, is funding for so-called abstinence plus education. In fact, one of the bills in Congress right now would change the state program funding to states to allow states to use funding for so-called abstinence plus, essentially other programs that were medically accurate and showed evidence of program effectiveness, to be funded out of the ab-only funding stream. Now, of course, folks who support abstinence only are going to be opposing that, but it's a huge investment. I mean, the federal government today is spending about $176 million on abstinence only education.
We talked a little bit earlier. You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that what we know now about adolescent sexual behavior, and that. That actually there has been a success story in that teen pregnancy rates have declined considerably in the last 15 years, that currently we believe that about half of kids in high school have had sexual intercourse, and that the median age of first sex is about 17 and a half, mm-hmm. which is about where it is for most developed countries. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that for a long time, people who were concerned about sex education and sexual activity among adolescents in this country looked at other developed countries, Europe particularly, and noted the fact that in a lot of other countries, at least the rates of teen pregnancy were lower than they were in the United States, and had said something like, well, obviously they know something we don't. There's got to be some significant difference between what we, and who knows what, I'm not sure people really knew what it was, whether it had to do with something about societal attitudes towards sex, or the way that parents talk with their children about sex, or it might have had something to do with availability of information and access to contraception. Now, there probably were a number of things in there. Is there now still such a marked difference, do you think, in the kinds of things we're talking about?
Yeah, unfortunately there still are those marked differences. Not as big as it was, but you know, in the mid-90s, when we have the best studies, there were rates of teen pregnancy were 5 to 7, even tenfold higher in the U.S. compared to most other developed countries. The rate, for instance, in Italy and in Japan is 1/10 of our teen pregnancy rate. We've been looking at some recent data, and some of those, again, it looks like it's shrunk a little bit, but still we still lead the developed world in our teen pregnancy rates, and also in our teen STD rates. So what's different? You know, some people point to sex ed, and I think probably sex ed is a little better in Europe. But people also look to things like societal attitudes, you know, adult attitudes. And, you know, kids pretend they're not listening to us, but they're always listening to us in reality. And I think the attitude in Europe is that responsibility is making sure that one is having sex, is one's protected. I think that notion is really very important. So I think in this country, many people have seen sex as the problem. In Europe, I think most adults see not using contraception as the problem.
So the big difference, it's not in level of sexual activity. It is in rate of contraceptive use?
The primary difference is in, there was a big five-country study that looked at this. They looked at Canada, Sweden, Great Britain, France, and the Netherlands, okay? And rates of sexual activity was pretty identical across those. Rates of contraceptive use was much higher among the European kids, and consequently, teen pregnancy rates were much lower. I just looked at some data from 15-year-olds at the school survey, again, primarily Europe, includes Israel, a few other countries. But, again, we're seeing the same kind of thing, much better contraceptive use, particularly pill use, but also so-called dual use, or people call it the double Dutch method in Europe. People call it the belt and suspenders. Sometimes, you know, kids doubling up, using a condom and an oral contraceptives at the same time. Much higher rates of dual use in Europe. That's a study that will be coming out in several months. But, you know, I mean, again, it suggests that European adolescents are, you know, much more concerned and much better contraceptive users than U.S. kids.
Okay. Just here real quickly, I'd like to pass on to people some weather information. I've just got Jay Searles, our meteorologist, just handed me a severe thunderstorm warning. The National Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for southeastern Morgan County in west central Illinois and southwestern Sangamon County in central Illinois. That will be in effect until 11:30 this morning. These include some of the places that could be impacted include Waverly, Laomi, Auburn, Di Vernon, and Pawnee. The storm has history producing destructive winds, so they say you should seek shelter inside a sturdy structure. Stay away from windows. You can report any weather or damage to your local emergency manager or to the nearest law enforcement agency. They'll pass that on to the Weather Service. So again, this is a severe thunderstorm warning that has been issued for southeastern Morgan County in west central Illinois and southwestern Sangamon County in central Illinois until 11:30. That adds on to the fact that we do have a severe thunderstorm watch that will be in effect until 3 this afternoon. So for a good part of the day in our listening area, there will be the possibility of severe weather. And this watch now does include Shelby, Christian, Sangamon, Clark, Cumberland, and Moultrie counties. So we'll pass on that information, more weather on the information as soon as it becomes available. Just one sort of final question here. We have about a minute or two left. I think that in recent years, people who study sexual behavior have been kind of frustrated because they make this argument that says this is an important part of human behavior, and we really need to understand what people do and how and when and where, and that they've felt frustrated that there are some people in the political spectrum who essentially would say, we don't want to know, and that at least has made it difficult to secure public funding for these kinds of studies. Is that something that you have experienced in your work?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It still is difficult to do research with young people on these matters. I think sometimes, I hate to say it, I think adults have their heads in the sand about that and just don't want to know. You know, again, as a father, as a pediatrician, as a medical guy, you know, the more I can know about a problem, the better off I am. And so, you know, all the data I talked about today, we wouldn't have that data. We wouldn't even know that abstinence had been increasing if we hadn't been measuring it very carefully. But those programs don't get a lot of support because, you know, some people are squeamish even talking about it. I mean, you're in an educational institution. I'm in one. I'm a strong believer in education as a, you know, as the way to make young people stronger, you know, against whatever forces are out there. It's the preparation for life. So I think sex education is just another piece of it. I don't think it has, people worry about bad effects, but we don't see those. What we see is actually good effects, and, you know, the more the merrier, as far as I'm concerned. The better we can do a job of educating our young people, the better off they're going to be.
Well, there we're going to have to stop as we have come to the end of the time. Our guest, John Santelli, he is a pediatrician and adolescent medicine specialist. He's department chair, population and family health, also professor of clinical population and family health at the Mailman School of Public Health. That's at Columbia University. And Dr. Santelli, thank you very much.
David, thank you. You're a wonderful and fair-minded interviewer on a difficult subject. Thank you for treating it so fairly.
Well, we appreciate your time.